Welcome to Now Appalachia. The Appalachian region covers 13 states in the U.S., and over 25 million people call the region home. This podcast profiles the authors and publishers with connections to Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their creative work. And now, here's your host, author and Appalachian resident, Elliot Parker.
And hello, friends. Welcome back once again to Now Appalachia. We are carried and distributed across the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, not only throughout the region of Appalachia, but also in over 100 countries throughout the world. Each and every time we bring you a broadcast here on the program, that's where you can find us, across any podcast platform that you are looking for. So we're glad to be with you once again for another episode of the program. I'm your host, Elliot Parker. It's great to have you with us. Glad to be back with you for the first time after a brief hiatus. If you've been following the program, or if you're a regular subscriber or listener to the podcast, you know that we haven't done an episode since about December of 2023. I had a little bit of a medical issue that was resolved, thankfully, after some brief complications, but we are back and in good shape and ready to go for another series and another year of outstanding programs and outstanding author and publisher profiles here on the program. And I just wanted to say thanks to everyone for all of your emails, messages, encouragements, questions about myself and what happened to the show, and where were we, and were we ever coming back, and did we get put on a permanent hiatus? Appreciate all those questions and feedback and comments, but it was very much appreciated, and I appreciate all the kind words that were shared. But we're back, we're ready to go, and we're kicking off 2024 with an outstanding new book that you're going to love. It is called No Perfect Mothers. Our guest today is author Karen Spears Zacharias, and she joins us as an American writer whose work focuses on women and justice. She holds an MA in Appalachian Studies from Shepherd University and MA in Creative Media Practice from the University of West Scotland. And she lives currently at the foot of the Cascade Mountains in Oregon, but she has also taught First Amendment rights at Central Washington University, and she continues to teach writing workshops around the country. And this is her brand new book, No Perfect Mothers, and it is terrific, and I can't wait to talk to her about it and about her career as a writer. So Karen, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us today.
Thank you, Elliot. It's great to be here.
I wanted to ask you, this being your fourth book now, your fourth novel, in terms of writing this book and the whole process of seeing it to publication, how was this one similar to or different from the others that you had published?
You know, it's at the Appalachian Conference this weekend, poet E.J. Wade and I did a panel discussion on our mother's diaspora out of Appalachia. I'd heard a quote that said the most Appalachian thing people do is leave it. And it was like, there are a lot of complicated reasons why that happens. But I told the audience at our panel that it seems that I have a mother thing going on. My memoir for HarperCollins was called Hero Mama originally. It's After the Flag now. But then came Mother of Rain, my first novel that won the Weatherford. And then this book, No Perfect Mothers. I definitely have a mother theme running through all of my work. But of course, that would be natural, right? Women bear children. So the way this was different is I think it took the strengths that I have as a journalist, which call for a lot of research. So I did quite a bit of research for this, but then it brought in my strengths as a novelist in imagining the things that I didn't have archival data for.
Very good. Very good. Well, the research really shows up well in the book, and we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. I wanted to ask you, in doing some preparation for the interview today, I found a quote that you said, which I think ties into the story, but I think it also ties into more of a broader context in terms of the book and your writing and your philosophy. And I wanted to share this quote with you and just have you kind of expand upon this. And this ties directly to the court, and this ties to the Supreme Court more specifically, and one of your characters in the book, the main protagonist that we follow, Carrie Buck. And you said this, you said, if we learn nothing else from Carrie's story in your novel, I hope we learn that the Supreme Court of the United States is fallible. History is replete with sorrowful stories created by wrongheaded decisions that we've made. Who we elect matters.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that quote and how that kind of connects to Carrie's story specifically in your novel.
Well, I think that at least where I grew up in Appalachian in the South, there's this mysticism around the Supreme Court. I actually think it probably was, you know, across the U.S. I think we're acculturated to it. I think we're taught that the, I mean, embedded in the name alone is the idea that they are supreme beings and that they're above doing wrong. And yet the history of the Supreme Court does not show that, does not prove that at all. In fact, the history of the Supreme Court proves quite the opposite of that. Whenever progress has been made by the Supreme Court, it's been a struggle, and it doesn't take place immediately. It's year after year after year of back and forth. We can look at Roe v. Wade and see, you know, the back and forth on that. We can look at the Dred Scott decision, see the back and forth on that. You know, it is definitely a politicized court. I don't care what anybody says. Of course it's politicized. It's a religious court to a large degree, not unlike lately, not unlike the Taliban. It's being, you know, the decisions it's making are rooted in religion.
And, you know, what's interesting, too, about that, thinking about that in the court is we also forget that these people are human beings and they can be they had struggle with all the same, you know, human emotions and fallacies that we all have. But they also can be persuaded and influenced. And if you look at, I had a good friend of mine who's an attorney tell me one of the most interesting classes he ever took in law school was a history of the Supreme Court. And what you find out is that there is a lot of, he kind of called it soap opera drama that goes on.
Yes.
You study the history
yes.
of the court behind the scenes,
right.
Between, you know, justices, you know, pitted against one another behind the scenes, between presidents trying to get this justice elected, mm-hmm. and then that falls apart, and then they go to this justice, and the second justice ends up being not the justice they thought this person was going to be, and so on and so forth. And it's just interesting that the human fallacy of just human beings and everything that we sort of see in politics in general, kind of back to your point, with it being politicized, still manifests itself in the court too. It's just in a different way, I think.
Yes, but I mean, look at the makeup of the court for the, you know, decades upon decades upon decades as a white male court. And when you think about it, what we've had three people of African-American descent on that court. That's it. In all of our history. Obviously, representation matters. And if your Supreme Court of the United States is made up of only a certain segment of your populace, they're only going to represent that segment. And there was a great article, and I can't remember who it was by, but a great article about Neil Gorsuch and how his mother had worked for the EPA. And she had had a very contentious relationship with the EPA. And the article was presupposing that, or suggesting that Gorsuch's moves on the Supreme Court are directed in large part by a need to fix the wrongs done to his mother.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. Very, very interesting and fascinating. And it's something that I think everybody should study. If you get a chance to kind of read some books about the court and its composition, even going back to the days when John Marshall was on the court going forward, I think you'll find some really interesting and fascinating reading. So I appreciate you sharing your perspectives on that. But your book more specifically, No Perfect Mothers, set in the 1920s in Charlottesville, Virginia, And we have this very sort of plucky but great character in Carrie Buck. And my understanding is she is, you did a lot of research, and she is real. Like, her story is
Yes.
real. What you write about is real. What got you interested in her, and what made you kind of gravitate to her and her story to the point where you sat down and thought, you know, I want to write, you know, a sort of a fictionalized novel of her experience?
The thing that led me to the story to begin with was a news article. This will surprise nobody who knows I'm a journalist, you know, former journalist, but I often pull things out of the headlines. But it was a news story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and the news story was about a group of immigrant women being held at an ICE detention center in South Georgia, and a woman who was a nurse at that facility, Dawn Wooten, a Black woman, came along and became a whistleblower because they had a doctor at that ICE detention center that was sterilizing these women without their consent and sometimes without their knowledge and often without their consent. And this was in 2020 when I read this headline story sitting at my desk in Oregon. And I thought, how can you sterilize people against their knowledge without consent? How can, I mean, I get that they're undocumented immigrants. That doesn't give you the right to sterilize them. And how did that ever happen in the United States of America, where half the population apparently doesn't have freedom? So I began researching the legality of that. And that led me to the Buck versus Bell Supreme Court case of 1927 that gave all the states' lawmakers the right to sterilize whomever they deemed unfit to be a parent. Each state has their own process, but it is still law to this day. So you put the Dobbs decision, which says state lawmakers can rule that women are forced to have children, up against the Supreme Court decision of 1927 that says I can sterilize whomever I decide. And the one common denominator, they're both federal laws. They're both still on the books. They're obviously both still being practiced. If you put those laws, what is the common denominator? State lawmakers. Who are state lawmakers? Primarily white men.
Yeah, interesting point. Yeah, very interesting. And I know this idea of sterilization, pregnancy, motherhood, you were talking about a few moments ago, really permeates a lot of Carrie's story, because she's abandoned by her father, we find out early in the novel. She's taken from her mother. She kind of goes into this foster care system, such as it was back in the 1920s. And
or such as it still is today.
Yeah, such as it still is. Yeah, it's very true. Yeah, in some ways, it's changed since the 1920s. In many ways, it has not. Right. Not in a good way, for certain. But she is basically forced, Carrie is at a young age, to work as a domestic. And then by the time she turns 17, she ends up pregnant. And one of the storylines that you have, which is just so poignantly done, and I loved how you constructed this, is that the foster parents whose nephew assaulted Carrie, they don't want it to find out, or they don't want anyone to find out it was their nephew that committed the sexual assault. And so they commit her to the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what that was like researching that and sort of what this sort of colony was responsible for and how that impacts Carrie when she gets sent there?
Well, the Virginia Colony is located right outside of Lynchburg. In fact, you can stand on property there at the colony and look across the hills and see Liberty University right there. Interestingly enough, that's a story in and of itself, considering the lawsuit they just had to settle. But yeah, I went to the colony property in 2021, and I was obviously already deep into the research at that point. The colony looks not unlike what could be a private school, college campus. Now, didn't look like that then, but it was more like a farm labor camp, I would say. Agriculture, they had people out there growing gardens and doing menial jobs. But this was during a time when the eugenics movement was rooted in the United States. Now, the eugenics movement wasn't just a United States movement. This was a worldwide movement, not unlike some of the worldwide movements we're seeing currently across the world. But this particular movement was the notion that to create a better society, the way you did that was you only let the better people breed. And in that situation, we're talking about the wealthier people, the whiter people, the people whose mores and values reflected a white nationalist philosophy. Wow, wonder where that came from. Anyway, that was the idea. And look, Margaret Sanger of Planned Parenthood, she was a big eugenicist. Walt Whitman, big eugenicist. In fact, the title of the book comes from a Walt Whitman poem where he's touting eugenics. And I take that and turn it on its head. But, you know, Charles Darwin, it all goes back. It was very prominent in England, but nobody practiced it as well as the United States did until Hitler came along. He did it better than we did it. But make no mistakes, I mean, there are currently still people being sterilized against their will without their knowledge. There are 31 states with laws on the books right now that allow for this kind of sterilization. And under federal law, it's allowed. One of the things I did when I was there in Charlottesville is, or in the Lynchburg area, I did Charlottesville and then Lynchburg. When I was in Lynchburg, I went to one of the libraries and was speaking with the archivist there. And he told me about a man he knew who had been incarcerated there at the camp, at the colony. And these colonies were all over. We had them in Oregon as well. And he told me that the man was deemed feeble-minded, but he was not feeble-minded. He just was uneducated. And of course, you know, after a while, after they sterilize them, they release them back into the public because you don't want to spend your money caring for people that you've harmed.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm a cynic about that, but
I that's right. And I'm so glad you mentioned Hitler, because when I was reading about that section in your book, the first thing I thought of was, oh, this is very similar to what Hitler wanted to do with creating the Aryan race, and that only certain people that he deemed acceptable, you know, and of course that led to the extermination of the Jews and other things, right. You know, the gypsies and homosexuals and all kinds of other groups that he deemed other during that period. So it's really interesting how sometimes history follows a linear path and not a good way. And, you know, one of the great things about that whole section of your book, and it's just done so well, because I loved it because it was so much about the emotion of Carrie, what she's experiencing, the conversations that she has. And you do such a great job of letting us know this is not a good place that she's in without making it too overly grotesque. I mean, we get a sense that this is a sad, awful place, but it's really about, you know, her and her situation as she goes through that. And I loved the ally that she meets, Miss Mora, who is a Scottish immigrant. And when we talk about, you know, Carrie being kind of labeled sort of an other, and eventually, you know, because she's pregnant at 17, and because we learned that Dr. Pretty, who is this colony, this Virginia colony superintendent, labels her eventually an imbecile, labels Carrie an imbecile. But Miss Mora herself has some own racial barriers that she has to face. I mean, Carrie desperately needs her at various points earlier in the story, but she's got her own issues. What's going on with her? And talk about their friendship, because it's just so wonderfully built and done. And On the surface, it looks like two characters that have nothing in common with one another and would have nothing to come together over, but their relationship and their friendship works so well. So what is the racial challenge that she's facing as a Scottish immigrant? And then talk to us a little bit about the relationship and that friendship that develops between her and Carrie.
Well, when I was working on the book, I was actually living in Scotland during part of that. And I had an opportunity to really befriend and talk to several Scottish people and to take a tour of the Midwifery Museum there in Glasgow. And of course, I think my worldview in a lot of ways is built along the lines of the allies I've had in my life, what I call the unlikely friendships of life, and how those unlikely friendships have benefited me. I didn't have any archival data to suggest that Carrie had such an ally in her life, so I wanted to create an ally for her, because we all need that unlikely friendship, that person who comes alongside and is our cheerleader and our rock and our friend through thick and thin. And that's especially true for women as they age, that isolation is detrimental to our health. So Carrie had spent most of her life isolated. She was cut off from her mother. She was cut off from her half sister and half brother. And it was a matter of who will befriend Carrie and be that helper in her life. So when I was in traveling in Scotland and studying, I had a friend there, E.J. Wade from Oak Park, Illinois. And she is a person of color. So I went to write against the stereotype that we so often see in media. I think it's important that just as we need to show diversity in Appalachia, not all Appalachians look like David Joy, as he said in his presentation this weekend. No, I mean, Appalachia is very diverse. We know that the Scots immigrated to Appalachia because of the connection to the land. They weren't all just white who came here. Black Scots came here as well. So I have Miss Moore as a Black Scot and a woman of means, an independent woman who made her living in a profession, and at that time, the profession being midwife. So she had been the attendant to Carrie's grandmother when Carrie's mom was born. And then she becomes Carrie's advocate. She's just a young teen when she delivers Carrie's mom, but she carries out that friendship and you know, that unlikely friendship throughout Carrie's life. And she really is the one person that Carrie, that is nurturing to Carrie, that comes along beside her and walks life's journey with her.
Karen Zacharias is our guest here on this episode of Now Appalachia. We're talking to her about her brand new novel. It's called No Perfect Mothers. And Karen, we'll come back to the book in just a second. But I wanted to ask you about writers that have influenced you, whose work has influenced you or maybe is currently influencing you, or maybe an author or two that you look back on or look back to when you need some inspiration or perspective as you're writing. Who are some of those authors? What are some of those books that have inspired you?
Yeah, so I would say the first book that really, and this early on in my career, and I was working as a journalist at the time, was Dennis Covington's Salvation on Sand Mountain. Very powerful book about the snake handling churches of the South. Not that I was a member of the snake handling churches, I wasn't, but I knew people that were entrenched in that. Dennis had a way of writing that was unusual in that he becomes part of that story. And so he's hired by National Geographic to kind of document these things. And then he gets caught up in this. And it's fascinating. Dennis was a remarkable writer, of course. The second, and I've talked about this many times, the person who put out the clarion call that brought me back to Appalachia was Silas House. I was working as a journalist. I was at a Society of Professional Journalists conference in Portland. I walked across the street to Pell's bookstore. Clay's Quilt was a new release. I picked it up, went back to my hotel room, and stayed up all night reading the book. And heard the voices of my parents, my grandparents from Rogersville, Tennessee, on both sides of the family. And I had been cut off from Appalachia for a very long time after my mother left the South in 1974. And so by this point, it's in the late, well, early, it's early aughts when I picked up Silas's book. And all of that time, I had been cut off from my roots. And so that book called me back to that. There are so many great books out there, so many wonderful writers. I love Patty Lee's, Patty Callahan Henry book, The Secret Book of Flora Lee, excellent book. Patty and I started in this business together. I've watched her grow, and she's just done a fabulous job. From a literary standpoint, the book I read recently that I just loved is an older book by Nancy Huron. It's called Under the Wide and Starry Sky, and it tracks Robert Louis Stevenson's life. An excellent book.
Very good, very good. And this book, your new book, No Perfect Mothers, was published by Mercer University Press. How did you connect with them? What is that experience like? And I know you've been very complimentary of the press and kind of their mission in connection to your book. So how did you find them, and what's that been like working with them on the publication of your book?
So I actually started out in 1997 with Mercer on my very first book when I didn't have a clue what I was doing. Let me be clear about that. I had no idea what I was doing. I was in grad school. A professor in the university there in Oregon had pulled me aside. I was 38 years old. I had four kids, young kids. And he said, "You're a writer." I laughed and said, "I grew up in Georgia. I can barely spell, much less write." And he said, "No, you're a writer and you must make time to write." And I realized when I was writing, the kids would leave me alone. So I spent more time writing than I did parenting for a while. And they were great about it. And somebody said, "You're like Thurman, I'm back from hell," which I thought was a compliment. So that I wrote, the very first book I wrote was on Georgia's first elected woman jurist. And her name was Judge Ruth McCombs. And she had been the mother of a childhood friend. She was getting ready to retire and she wanted me to write her memoirs. She told me later she picked me to write it because I lived 3,000 miles from her and she wouldn't have to look me in the face. She told me those stories, and I'm like, "But they go to print." So it was actually Louis Grizzard's agent, Tony Privet, who put me in touch with Mercer. He and Bob Steed and Elena Amos, who was married to John Amos, the founder of Aflac, they were all cheering me along. And Mark Jolly at Mercer published my first book, Benched. It was nominated that year for author, Georgia Author of the Year. Jimmy Carter won it, rightly so. But that was my first book. And when I went to do fiction, I went back to Mercer. I had published with HarperCollins and some other companies by that point. But I went back to Mercer because I knew that they were the go-to place for Melungeons. And I wanted Maisie, I wanted Birdie to be a Melungeon character. I had never seen a Melungeon character in fiction at that point. I wanted to write the book in Appalachian dialect, and I wanted that Melungeon connection because my grandmother was Melungeon on my dad's side.
Very good.
So I went back to Mercer, and Mark and the team came along, and Mark's just been a great support to my work. And what a lot of people don't know is that's a staff of like 5 people. And they're turning out some of the best literary fiction in the South currently. And I couldn't ask for a better team of people to work for. I've been in New York. I've worked with those teams. They were great. But on my last New York publication, I was out for 1 week and they fired 35 editors, and one of them was mine. Layoffs, they called it. But, you know, it impacted people's lives. I've been with Mark for 3 decades now. There's something great about that kind of relationship.
Yeah, very well said. Karen Zacharias is our guest on Now Appalachia. Her brand new novel is called No Perfect Mothers. And we're going to go back to the book for just a few moments here in our remaining minutes together. And Karen, I wanted to read just a small passage on page 96, chapter 14. I was trying to look for a sentence or two that kind of encapsulated what everyone is experiencing in this novel. And I love the way that you introduce this chapter. And it's really specifically talking about Maura, who we talked about, Miss Maura, who we talked about a moment ago. But I just love these first couple of sentences because I think it speaks to really all the women in this story, what they're going through. Even the mother of Carrie, who eventually kind of gives up on her. I think all of these women are experiencing this. And you write on page 96, you start off that chapter 14, by saying, "They walked the rest of the way in silence, each thinking of those they missed, each wishing that life had been gentler to the women they loved, wishing life had been kinder to them as well." And I feel like when I'm reading and learning about all of these wonderful characters and everything that happens to Carrie, as you've talked about, and Miss Maura and their relationship and everything that goes on at that Virginia colony for the epileptics and feeble-minded, there is this sense that all of these women are looking for that they're all kind of wishing life had been different or was different for them, or maybe thinking back, could they go back to a certain period and change something to change the trajectory of where they are? Is that really the main, one of the main takeaway themes you hope readers walk away from with this novel, no matter if they're following Carrie's story or they're interested in Miss Maura or whatever, that, or whoever, that they get a sense that all of these women are kind of struggling with this dichotomy of dreams versus reality versus expectations?
Yeah, I think that if I can be even more clear about that, I talked to a reader last night and she said she got so angry reading the book, thinking of what had happened to Carrie and what is continuing to happen to women today. And that's how I look at it. It's not just Carrie's story. This is a story about women today, women out of Oklahoma, women out of Texas, women out of Georgia, out of Alabama. You look at the Republicans who just put a young girl in the kitchen to give the rebuttal to the State of the Union. I mean, that is a very strong message. Even if she had never said one word, you put her in the kitchen. And we have in this country, there's no getting around it. We have embedded patriarchy in our institutions. And look, I watched a movie at church last night on the Philadelphia 11 about the women who fought to be accepted into the priesthood in the Episcopal Church. And this was back in 74. They could not have gotten there had it not for been the male allies who came alongside those women and fought for them to be brought into the priesthood. It took men in position of power to be an ally to a woman to then open the door for women. And I think that that's what I am so desperate to see in our current, I have three daughters. I have one granddaughter. I am desperate to see those allies and men step forward and be advocates for women so that we are, because look, if women aren't free, you can't be partially free. You have to be totally free. If you do not have body autonomy, you are not free. We know that from slavery. We know that from Roe v. Wade. There are people who want to and are taking away freedoms from women.
Very well said. In our final moments with you today, Karen, if anyone wants to keep up with you on social media, find out what you're up to, what you're working on, what you're doing with your book, No Perfect Mothers, where can they stay in contact with you? How can they find you out on social media and out on the internet? And then secondly, where can they get copies of No Perfect Mothers?
Yeah, well, you can get copies of No Perfect Mothers at Mercer University Press, but also at any of your local independent booksellers or anywhere else that you buy books, and hopefully at your libraries. You can stay in touch with me at KarenZack.com on my blog. I'm at Instagram at KarenZack and at Facebook under my name. I do not do Twitter for obvious reasons, misogyny related to that guy who owns it. But yeah, it's been great. And I do hope that both men and women read this book. And then I hope they do the thing I ask them to do, which is go out and vote for the rights of women to have their own freedoms.
The title of the brand new novel published by Mercer University Press, it's called No Perfect Mothers. And we've been delighted to spend the last few minutes with Karen Zacharias, who's the author of this book. It's her fourth novel. And as she said, it's a terrific book. I loved it. I felt so many emotions as I was reading it. I was happy in spots, but I was mad and sad in other spots. But it really forces you to think a lot about what we've been talking about here on the program. And I would encourage anyone to pick this up and to read this, because it is a fascinating story based on a true story of 17-year-old Carrie Buck in the 1920s. And as Karen mentioned earlier, it led to a 1927 Supreme Court case. And so it is something that still resonates with us today. Karen, it's a terrific novel, so well done in so many ways. And thanks for coming on to spend some time with us today to talk about it, and all the best to you in the future.
Thank you, Ellie. And thank you for caring about Carrie so much. That's what we all need to do, is care for each other more.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And we want to take a moment as we finish up on this episode of Now Appalachia and our final moments here to give a special shout out to our executive producer, Pam Stack. She makes all of these podcasts possible. And if you're a follower of all the programming on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, she's responsible for all that as well. So thank you so much, Pam, for all the work that you do to make these podcasts possible. We also want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And that is going to do it for us this time on Now Appalachia, but please come again next time. And in the meantime, stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
You've been listening to Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. For questions or comments about this program, and to learn more about the host, Elliot Parker, and his books, visit his website at www.elliottparker.com. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next from the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.